Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. The 2020 general election is coming up, or should we say that it's coming to an end? Early voting has broken records. With us now is Fayette County Clerk Don Blevins. He's at the epicenter of the vote count for Central Kentucky's most populous county, Fayette County. And do we have questions? Thanks for joining us, Don.
Nice to talk to you again, Tom. Fire away. What do you got?
Okay. First, I've seen forecasts that for the first time in American history, it looks like most Americans probably will vote in advance of Election Day. Do you think that prediction will turn out to be accurate?
I believe so, yes. Many states have expanded to early voting as a part of the response to the COVID crisis. So we're going to see more Americans vote early that way. And then in addition to that, a lot of states have expanded absentee ballots or mail vote by mail in some cases. And in those cases, people will have voted well before Election Day. So it's going to be a very different year for America.
When you hear this claim that this could lead to voter fraud, what are your thoughts about that?
There is literally no evidence that there is voter fraud associated with particularly mailed ballots. The voter fraud that still exists in America is good old-fashioned vote buying. That still occurs occasionally, but people are caught and sent to jail. I saw an interesting anecdote, if you don't mind. There's a fairly conservative think tank in Washington, and I'll think of it here in a minute, but it's one that everybody would know, had published all of the supposed vote fraud over time in all the states. So being a curious person, I went and looked, and sure enough, there's some entries for Kentucky. There were about 13, 14, maybe 15 total entries for when vote fraud or vote problems had occurred. And the outcome of all 15 was a conviction. People try it occasionally. We catch them and we put them in jail. So I don't think the average voter needs to worry about it. There's no evidence. Our own Republican Secretary of State has stated that in Kentucky for the primary, there were zero cases of vote fraud. I can tell you that for Fayette County, there were zero cases of vote fraud. And had there been at either the state level or the local level, we would have prosecuted.
Okay, so we've established that a lot of people are voting early. They're sending in their ballots. And I wonder, is the process of counting those ballots already underway, or does that not begin until after the polls close on Election Day?
Oh, yes. We've been counting ballots since about October the 5th or so. So we got an early start on that. Back around, say, the middle of October, we had already received about 45% of our ballots. So folks were returning their ballots in a timely fashion. That's always a good thing. It helps us in terms of processing. But more importantly, this time, Tom, it gave us a chance to send them a letter should there be a problem with their ballot and give them time to either repair the problem in the case of a signature mismatch or to cancel their absentee ballot and go ahead and vote in person if there was something catastrophic with their return ballot. That was an important change this time that should reduce our rejection rate to almost zero.
Are there measures in place to prevent the leaking of those early tallies?
Well, yes. We won't even run the machines. We won't pull the tallies off the machines that we've been using until probably Monday, November the 2nd. We'll probably start doing that in anticipation of Tuesday night.
How have you been making sure that the drop-off boxes that have been placed around the county are secure and that they're protected from being vandalized or tampered with in some way?
Well, several ways. First of all, they're designed for this. If you've used one, you'll know that the little slit where your ballot goes in is purposely designed to be very small to not allow, to restrict at least the ability to put foreign objects in the boxes. They're all under electronic surveillance at all times, 24 hours a day. We've also taken the extra precaution of emptying them every day so that if there is an incident, it'll be reduced to just a few voters.
How are people prevented from voting twice, filling out a mail-in ballot and then trying to vote in person on Election Day?
Well, there's another way to do it, too, which is to vote at multiple locations or attempt to vote at multiple locations. Mm-hmm. In all three cases, once you vote, that's recorded in our system. And then we're using electronic poll books in Fayette County for the first time. These replace the old paper rosters that you would sign when you showed up to vote in person. And they're all interconnected via a separate, highly secure network that is not the internet. It's its own network. And they remain in constant communication with each other so that when, say, Tom votes by mail, then once your ballot arrives, actually after you request it, they already know that you've requested a ballot by mail, so you won't be able to vote at the polls. If Neil has showed up at one location and voted, that is relayed to all the other locations so that he can't go to a second location and vote. So basically, it's automation using these new electronic technologies.
What's your advice, Don Blevins, if somebody goes to the polls to vote and they're told that they aren't registered or for some other reason they won't let them vote?
Well, you have two options. By federal law, you can vote at what's called a provisional ballot. That's a ballot for all the federal races that you place in a special envelope, and those are brought back to the office for processing on Election Day. And the local county board of elections will decide, you know, whether the reason that you were told you couldn't vote was valid or not, and then your vote will either be counted or not. Most of the time when provisional ballots are used, it's because the person wasn't registered properly or on time or even at all, in which case they'll have to be rejected because in Kentucky you have to be registered by a particular date or else you're ineligible to vote. A second option is that you can appeal to the County Board of Elections by appearing before them, stating your case, and if the local county board elects under certain circumstances, we can authorize you to vote, and you can be sent out to one of the in-person locations. So those are the two options in that particular situation.
Okay. If we've filled out the absentee ballot and sent it in, is there a way for us to check to make sure that that mail-in ballot has been received and recorded?
Well, the only thing that you can do in terms of checking on the status of the ballot is go to govoteky.com, and you'll be able to see whether we've received it or not. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the system that we're using is literally brand new, built over the summer, and doesn't have the advanced capabilities that some states have where you can even tell whether it was counted or rejected and that sort of thing, which is why in this particular election, the state board regulation has allowed for a methodology to contact voters should there be an issue. So rather than having you check up on your ballot, what we're doing is reaching out to you and telling you there's a problem.
So if you requested a mail-in ballot and you didn't get one for some reason, can you vote in person on Election Day?
After October the 28th, so we're timely, that's a timely question, yes. What you do is you call my office and say, hey, I've never received my ballot. What do I do? And we will cancel your ballot in our system so that if you have sent it in and we just haven't received it yet, it won't be able to be counted when it finally arrives. And that will enable you to go vote in person at one of the various locations.
We hear that ballots in other states have been thrown out for so-called signature mismatches. Has that occurred here, and what do you do about it?
No, you won't get your ballot thrown out for a signature mismatch. A couple of surprises there. In the primary, we had something close to a 99% match rate. I was amazed. I have to tell you, I was fully expecting thousands of ballots to be problematic. Mm-hmm. But instead, we only had about 50 or 60 in the primary. So what happened then was that we reached out to the voters individually. This time, because of the volume, the state board has created a system where if there's a signature mismatch, we send a letter to the voter that instructs them on how to cure it, and then they have to get that information back to the clerk before Election Day. If all is well, then we go ahead and count their ballot. Similarly, if you have some sort of issue with your ballot package that's just hopelessly not going to work and we have to reject it for normal reasons, then you will also receive a letter saying, hey, there was issues with your ballot. We're going to cancel it for you. Now you can go to the polls and vote in person.
There's been some concern about the mail. And I'm just wondering if voters should be concerned about mailing their ballot back, not getting there, being lost or stolen somehow. Are you recommending that to make sure that they drop off their ballot?
It would depend on the timing, Tom. I think early on, like in early October, I would have been fine with either method personally. However, at this point, being this late in the cycle, I would prefer that people go ahead and start using the drop boxes just to make sure.
The collection and counting of the mail-in ballots is expected to go past November 3rd. And that means there may not be an accurate depiction of the winner by November 4th. We're pretty sure that's going to be the case. Is there an estimate on when the final results will be released, a week or a month later?
Yeah, we are directed by the emergency regulation on how all this will pan out. It's going to be slightly different than the primary. I'm not sure if I like it or not, but I think the public might like this better. On election night, county clerks will be required to publish partial results to the election night reporting system hosted by the state board, just like a, sort of a normal election. And you'll see them trickle in, you know, the excitement will build. It'll be that kind of a night. They will, however, be partial results, and they'll consist of all the votes on election day itself, plus all the votes that were voted early voting in person, plus all of the votes that we've tallied so far via the mail and drop boxes up until that point. Now, if folks have turned in their ballots on time, or preferably early, then we should have a fairly accurate view of what's going to happen in the election on election night. But you're correct, it won't be all the way. So the second date that's important here is the following Friday. County clerks are required to additionally report whatever they've processed between election day and Friday. That'll probably take us to something close to 99% of all, you know, ballots counted. Hmm. And then the official final day is the following Tuesday, November the 10th. All county clerks are required to give certified results. And then that's when we'll know absolutely for sure. So for races that are not particularly close, you'll probably know election night. For close races, particularly smaller county-level races, might not be until the following Tuesday that we really know who won.
Okay, so we want to circle November 10th on the calendar just to be sure.
Yes, sir.
Many of us know somebody who made some bad decisions when they were younger and served time as a convicted felon, probably drug charges, something like that. What are the rules for that voting bloc?
Well, so the Governor Beshear, just after he took office, he restored the voting rights for a lot of the classes of felons that were basically nonviolent and so forth. So, you know, an early mistake in your late teens of drug usage or something like that, they can restore those rights. You needed to have contacted, there's a website run by the Department of Corrections that tells you whether you are eligible to have your voting rights restored. Then once you determine that you're eligible, you just contact your county clerk, register to vote, or you can go online at govoteky.com and register to vote, and you would have been able to vote this election. Now, the registration deadline, though, Tom, was October the 5th, so we're well past that. But these folks that are in this category, it's very easy to do, and they should look into it after the election.
So what do you think? Do you think Election Day ought to be a national holiday?
I would love for that, or move it to a Saturday. I think we ought to try one or the other of those options. I hear constant complaints about being able to get off from work and go vote, although I have some struggles in believing some people. You know, it just means they don't want to get up really early or go later in the day. Mm-hmm. It would be nice to remove at least that chunk of it and make it a national holiday. I would certainly support that. What's going to be difficult, though, Tom, is in the future, there's going to be a lot of pressure from Kentuckians on the lawmakers this coming general session, because everybody's loving voting by mail, and the ones that don't love voting by mail, they love the early voting. And this has been like running three simultaneous elections for county clerks. We're not going to be able to do this every time without some significant changes to how all this happens. So it's going to be very interesting this coming spring to see what the legislature does with this.
Well, we keep hearing that this pandemic is changing so many things in our lives. Do you think that might be one of them? Do you think that mail-in early voting is a thing that's going to be with us?
Great question. I have no idea, and here's why. We have a Republican legislature that generally is opposed to expanded absentee ballots like we're doing, and they're generally opposed to early voting. We'll just have to find out together. It's going to be very interesting this spring.
Well, Don Blevins, taking off your county clerk hat and swapping it for Don Blevins voter, how do you plan to make sure that your vote is counted?
Well, I've already voted. I got one by mail, and I elected to use a drop box some weeks ago. So that was my preference. I feel like it's the safest from a COVID point of view, and also safe and secure from a voting point of view.
As Fayette County Clerk Don Blevins, we thank you so much for your time, Don.
You're welcome. Happy to talk to you, Tom. I hope you all are doing well.
Fayette County Clerk Don Blevins touched on felon voting rights. We'll have more on that later in the hour. Tom Eblin's latest author interview for Eastern Standard brings us more information and details about the act of exercising your right to vote.
Joshua Douglas is a law professor at the University of Kentucky and an expert on election laws and the constitutional right to vote. He also is the author of Vote for Us, How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting, published last year by Prometheus Books. The book explores once arcane issues of voting rights and procedures that have become daily news fixtures as a contentious presidential election coincides with a global pandemic. Douglas worked with Kentucky officials this year to develop a bipartisan approach to expanded voting that has become a model for the nation. Josh Douglas is with us today to talk about his book, This Election and the Future of Voting. Josh, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get into current events, tell us a little about your book and what prompted you to write it.
Sure. So, when we think about the right to vote, it's often in terms of doom and gloom. We hear so many news stories about how it's harder to participate, how people are taking the right to vote away, that, our democracy is rigged somehow. And a lot of those stories are true in that things have become more difficult. There are often barriers put up to the ballot box. But at the same time, there's actually some good news about voting and democracy in local communities and the way in which we're trying to make the voting process more convenient, more inclusive, more democratic. And so the book tells about these reforms and does so through the stories of everyday Americans who are working to make our system better. And so, I highlight a bunch of different individuals in communities all over the country. I call them democracy champions. That are really working to make our system so much better for everybody.
Yeah, those were very interesting. What was your favorite of those? Just pick one to talk about.
I think some of the favorite are also the ones that are kind of the most surprising. And so I love the story about Katie Fahey, a young woman in Michigan, who was just kind of fed up with politics in general after the 2016 presidential election. And so 2 days after that election, she posted on Facebook and she said, "Hey, friends and family, I'm thinking of taking on gerrymandering in Michigan. Does anyone want to help?" And of course, gerrymandering is this practice of drawing district lines to essentially rig the elections so we know which party will win each seat. And both political parties do it. And Katie told me that, she wasn't really trying to start a movement. She was basically just nervous about Thanksgiving dinner that year because her family is pretty split. And she was like, "I can't tolerate the conversations that'll happen after the Trump-Clinton election. So what's something that kind of everyone can get behind, that everyone understands inherently is wrong with our system?" And she thought gerrymandering is it. And so she posted this on Facebook, and without going through all the details, it actually did start a movement. So many people started contacting her that she had to create a new organization called Voters Not Politicians. She ended up quitting her job and doing this full time. And they worked to get an amendment to the state constitution on the ballot for 2018 to create an independent redistricting commission to take the power to draw the lines away from the self-interested politicians and put it to the voters themselves. And that amendment passed pretty overwhelmingly. And so now for our next cycle of redistricting, which will happen in 2021, it'll be an independent commission that does it in Michigan instead of the entrenched politicians. And it just amazes me that one Facebook post really led to all of that.
Yeah, that's great. Well, what do you hope readers will take away and learn from this book?
I think the biggest message is that it takes all of us to make change, but yet all of us can make that change, or any of us can. The people I profiled in the book are not political elites. They're not kind of the people that we think of as that are in charge. They're everyday Americans who just decided, look, I'm going to try to make my local or state democracy a little bit better, and they were able to succeed. And, some might say they succeed over powerful odds, but still, we have good news all over the country in places you wouldn't expect it, in conservative places, liberal places, done by men, women, Democrats, Republicans, independents. all coming together to make our system more responsive, to make it more like a democracy. And so I think the takeaway is that it takes all of us, it's everyday Americans, it's individuals, and also that change can happen at the local level. And if we can create some of that change in, for our local democracies, that can spread to other places, it can spread to other communities, and then eventually throughout the country. And we see that in a lot of the reforms that I talk about.
Yeah, well, this election is like none this country's ever experienced before. What's your biggest concerns about the election from a national perspective?
My biggest concern is that we are in a period after November 3rd when the outcome is not clear for the presidential election and people start spreading claims, lies, really, of voter fraud, of election integrity problems, without any evidence whatsoever, and that undermines the legitimacy of the election process. We see that happening already. You know, unfortunately, the president tweets and makes all sorts of statements that are just patently false with respect to the way our elections operate. And the goal is to undermine the legitimacy of the election. And we need to all call that out. This isn't a partisan thing. This is a democracy thing. This is an American thing. And so my biggest concern is we're in a world in which we have a disputed election and we have lots of claims of voter fraud without any evidence whatsoever.
Yeah, well, a lot of people have said this is really dangerous. And what do you think we can do about it?
Well, I think we need to be very careful as consumers of the media and of information and the media themselves to be very clear about what's accurate information. We need to not prematurely call elections as completed. You know, we're kind of used to election night when we know the winners, late in the evening. And that's probably not going to be the case this year unless it's a blowout. Because especially in many of the swing states, they are processing mail-in ballots, perfectly legal, valid ballots that arrive after November 3rd, even though they're postmarked on or before November 3rd. Those ballots should count. And my concern is that, you know, you may see vote total shift. And this has happened in other places. In 2018, on election night, it looked like the Republican candidate in Arizona for the U.S. Senate race there was going to win. And then once all the ballots were cast, the Democrat won. This is referred to as the Big Blue Shift. Big Blue Nation knows all about things of Big Blue, and this is the Big Blue Shift because it shows how often later arriving ballots do tend to skew more Democratic, and for the Democratic candidate, that is. And that's perfectly normal. It's a phenomenon that has been demonstrated. So we need to all kind of take a deep breath, be ready to be in for a wait unless it's a blowout, and recognize that the system is working.
Well, what's your estimate on how long a wait we'll have? I mean, when do you think we will know?
You know, it really depends on various swing states. I mean, you know, if the election is close in Florida, which I think will report results earlier than some other states, then it's going to be a longer wait. You know, if Florida's a blowout one way or the other, that might give us a good signal about how some of the other states are going to go. But, you know, we could be in for a couple weeks while we wait for officials to process votes in Michigan, in Wisconsin, in Pennsylvania, in Ohio. And so, yeah, I mean, I think it really just depends on where we are in terms of the vote count with respect to whether we're going to have a longer wait or not.
Well, once this election's over, how do you think America should change its laws and procedures around voting?
You know, that's one, you know, if this could be any possible silver lining to the pandemic, it's really hard to find one, of course, with so many people dying and suffering. But it has showed us that we can make our voting system easier. And, you know, the book is a lot about how to make our system a lot more expansive and make it easier for people to participate. And, you know, election officials have had to scramble to respond to the pandemic, and they've proven that we can do things like expand vote by mail, expand the ability for people to access the ballot without any fraud concerns. And so I'm hopeful that these emergency measures that have been put in place to respond to an election during a pandemic can be made more permanent through the legislatures, as we've proven that this thing actually works, that, you know, we can have a higher turnout. We can make voting more convenient and easier without any integrity concerns. And, of course, that's what we should all want, right? Our democracy is based on the consent of the governed, is based on being responsive to everyone. So everyone who wants to should be able to vote easily. And, you know, we're seeing that more and more because of these new rules, and I'm hopeful that they can become permanent.
I was going to say, how hopeful are you that America can improve its election system?
I mean, I'm cautiously optimistic. I think I'm an optimist in general. That's why I wrote a book that was fairly optimistic. And I think the good news is that we'll have evidence now. You know, we'll have evidence from 2020. We already have it in the primary. As you mentioned, Kentucky was a model for how to do this in a bipartisan manner. So we have evidence. So, you know, often you hear this concern of, well, we need to protect the integrity of the election, or, you know, expanding vote by mail is going to lead to fraud. And that's often said without evidence. But now we're actually going to have real elections where it's proven that we ran a fair, free, fraud-free election, largely through the mails and through early voting without any problems. And so I just think the case is even that much stronger to do this. And once you see some states doing it, especially states that are both so-called red and so-called blue, then I'm hopeful that other states could do so as well. I mean, one quick example, before the pandemic hit, there were 5 states that automatically mailed every voter a ballot without a request. And that included blue states like Oregon and red states like Utah and purple states like Colorado. Now you have 5 more states that are doing that for this election in 2020. And, you know, I think we're going to see once again that they're red and blue and purple, and it just makes sense for the voters. And this is done without fraud. In Kentucky, I know the Secretary of State has said we need to clean up the voter rolls first. But I'm hopeful that once we do that, we can move to more expanded vote by mail.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. And this was Joshua Douglas, the author of Vote for Us, How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting, and a law professor at the University of Kentucky. Thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tom Eblin appears on Eastern Standard in partnership with the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning. And you can find Tom's author interviews under the series tab on our site, esweku.org. Coming up after the break, the case for ensuring roles for women in shaping policies that affect us all.
They're really making positive contributions, and we're losing out as a society by not having those voices represented.
And restoring voting rights to people with felony convictions in their past.
I never thought I'd have that again, but here I am.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Support for WEKU and Eastern Standard comes from Hicks & Funson, Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Shannon Church provide legal representation for auto accidents, medical malpractice, elder care, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.org or on the WEKU mobile app. Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-522-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
The right to vote may be taken for granted by most of us today, but it wasn't always so, and for some, it still isn't. First, the latest in our year-long series about the 19th Amendment brings the establishment of women's right to vote 1 century ago all the way to the present and to the very near future. Here's series co-host, EKU history professor Jackie Jay.
This is the election season installment of our series on the 19th Amendment, and today I'm here with Dr. Anne Cismar, associate professor in the Department of Government at EKU. She teaches numerous courses in American politics, and her research interests include the intersection between political parties and interest groups and public opinion and voting behavior, all topics that seem particularly relevant in the fall of 2020. Welcome, Anne, and thanks very much for talking with me today.
Thank you very much for having me.
So we've talked to a number of different historians on this series, but you're our first political scientist. So what is political science? What characterizes it as an academic discipline? And what role does the 19th Amendment play in political science?
So political science, broadly speaking, is the study of all governmental institutions, political behavior that leads to those governmental institutions, legitimate authority, and power. And so we have a pretty far-reaching discipline ranging from everything in normative political theory, which would describe how government should operate or what things ought to be like, all the way through to modern technological advancements and statistical advancements to do quantitative analysis on various topics. And we study international topics, comparative politics topics, doing case study type approaches across different countries or conflicts, American politics in a variety of forms, and statistical methods. So it's a pretty wide-ranging discipline. Across the board, though, as I mentioned, we do describe the nature of power and how it is exercised, how it should be exercised, who exercises the power, et cetera. And so the 19th Amendment comes into those conversations because when you think about the founding of America, it's a story of how a group of very prominent, very smart men, white men, get together and decide what the government should look like. But at that time, of course, women are prohibited from voting or participating in politics, along with people of color. And so we have to talk about overall the expansion of the electorate in the United States and globally, bringing other people's voices to the table. And so part of that, of course, is the 19th Amendment and giving women specifically the right to vote and how that process unfolded and the implications of that going forward for what government operates like and how the electorate behaves.
Yeah, and we've seen on this series that with the 19th Amendment, that doesn't mean that all women necessarily have the same right to vote. With the civil rights movement, black women were often barred before that. And yet women tend to be talked about as a distinct voting bloc in and of themselves. And I was really fascinated to discover that in the 1916 election, many women in Western states already had the right to vote in presidential elections. These women were urged to vote against Woodrow Wilson. At that point, he didn't support a federal suffrage amendment. That argument didn't work. They actually chose to vote for him because he wanted to try to keep America out of World War I. But we see there the potential power of women's votes. The 2020 election cycle has put such a strong focus on suburban women in particular, and so I was hoping you could unpack this idea a bit more for us. Have there often been specific groups of women whose votes are important, or is this a relatively rare thing?
So you bring up an important point about not describing women sort of in a monolithic way. In fact, I would argue that partisanship is a much more important determinant of people's vote choices, and also in terms of people's political attitudes, the type of political information they consume, how they engage in politics, et cetera. So gender, of course, has an important role, but it's more how it's filtered through partisanship and ideology and some of those other inherently political characteristics that I think really makes the big difference in people's voter turnout or voting behavior specifically. And so you touched on an important point here, which is looking at women sort of as a block of folks, as half the population, is not really that meaningful in understanding how women might behave or participate. I guess in terms of turnout studies, we do know that closer to the 19th Amendment's passage, you still had a lot of women who maybe didn't engage in voting at all. And then we call that the gender gap. And then coming into recent years, we've actually closed that gender gap. Women participate as often as men do, and actually in some cases, even at slightly higher percentages than men do. But in terms of voting behavior and who they'll actually choose in elections, you have to really unpack what it means to just have women as a voting bloc. So you have Republican women, you have women of color, you have women divided on abortion as an issue, and all of these things are going to be important for the vote choices that they would make in elections. Level of religiosity, of course, is different across women, and all of those are variables that I would say are more impactful in terms of predicting or understanding who people will vote for rather than just gender specifically. Although in recent years, women have been more heavily aligned on average with the Democratic Party, and for reasons that we could potentially explore or talk about if you're interested in that. But I think particularly in 2020, there's so much emphasis on suburban women voters, particularly white women voters, because it's a voting bloc that you might expect to vote Democratic on average, but in the 2016 election, in some cases, actually was decisive in potentially giving that election to President Trump. And so I think that's why you see this heavy emphasis in 2020's election on suburban white women voters, because the question is, are they going to stay with Trump and be a voting bloc that helps him go on to victory in 2020, or will they flip and vote for Biden, which could spell problems for President Trump in these critical battleground states. And so that's, I think, why we're seeing this intense focus on white suburban women, because they, you would expect them to vote Democratic theoretically. But again, we have to unpack what it means to be kind of a woman voter. And instead, they voted for Trump in 2016.
So it's really that intersection of factors, the fact that not just these are women we're talking about, but that they are white suburban women. And that is an interesting point that you make, that that women have been skewing more Democratic. Do you want to take just a minute to explore that?
Well, I think when you look on average at issues that are important to female voters, again, on average, I don't want to paint this with just broad strokes across the board, but it aligns more heavily with preferring perhaps some additional social safety nets, assistance for people at different income levels, paid family leave or other things to help support women in the workforce. And so as a result of that, I think it's why you see women on average skewing towards the Democratic Party. But again, I want to be very careful not to portray it as though all women are voting for Democrats or aligning with the Democratic Party, because there is a sizable chunk, obviously, that are voting Republican. And really in those key battleground states like Pennsylvania, which was decided by a few thousand votes in 2016, and they have all of those electoral college votes that go winner take all to whoever wins the state, even by a slim number of popular votes. You see that that electorate could be really critical, because if they flip over to Biden in 2020 instead of Trump, as they voted for in 2016, that could mean the difference in the election, even if it's only a few thousand people.
And you've mentioned that women's participation in voting has increased over the years. When we look at women's representation in elected office, the numbers there are still pretty low. We're looking somewhere in the range of 20 to 30% of elected officials in the United States being women at the moment. So why do you think those numbers are still relatively low, and do you think we'll get to 50-50 anytime soon?
So I don't think we're going to get to 50-50 anytime soon. I do think who you ask depends on what answer you'll get as to why women are still underrepresented in elected positions. So there are some famous political science scholars who essentially argue that women self-select out of running for office, and that's why you see fewer women in elected positions. Essentially, their argument is that women who do run for office tend to win at similar rates to men that run for office, but you just see fewer women choosing to run for office, and that perhaps that's family pressures or that's upbringing, socialization, other concerns that might prevent them from actually seeking office in the first place. I would say, though, I'm not sure that everybody fully agrees with that characterization, however, because you can imagine that that perceived selection bias, oh, women just choose not to run, but the ones who do run are very likely to win. It's also possible then that the women who are running for office, choosing to run for office, selecting to run for office, are the ones then who have disproportionate party support, already have a lot of fundraising money, or otherwise better qualified than male challengers might be. And so you're getting a selection bias that women don't run, but the ones who do are very successful. Well, perhaps that's because the women who run in the first place are actually better candidates. So if you compared them to a similarly positioned male candidate, perhaps their success rate is not as high, given that they're actually already a better qualified candidate. And of course, you know, the fact that women don't want to run for office could have something to do as well with the way that the media talks about women running for office, the types of pressures or criticisms that they might face, risks of threats to personal harm to them or their families, et cetera, as well.
Ah, fascinating statistics. And that the notion that that more qualified women are running is really interesting. And that, I think, ties into some of the broader trends we've been seeing recently brought to the forefront by the pandemic and the fact that there are so many inequities in our society, just one of which is the burden that's been placed on working mothers in particular. If you listen to NPR, you can hear it in the voices of Mary Louise Kelly and some of her colleagues, just that tension. And the September jobs report shows that it's far more likely for women to leave their jobs right now in the current climate. And part of that is because there's a lot of kids at home learning virtually this fall. And I don't think there are any easy answers, but do you think there's any way that women's voices and women's representation could help to address these inequalities?
So I definitely think that having better descriptive representation in Congress and across all levels of government would be a positive step for a number of reasons. Even just helping younger generations, even current generations, I suppose, be socialized into seeing that women are very competent and capable, even as mothers, they still have positive contributions to make to their workplaces, even if they have other pressures or other concerns. They bring other skills that are really beneficial to their workplaces. And so it's not as though we're just hiring them and keeping them along because we're trying to be equitable, but they're really making positive contributions. And we're losing out as a society by not having those voices represented. So I think that it provides this better kind of socialization or environment for people to observe the work of women and how women can be very successful in contributing members of different workplaces and environments. I'm not sure that just having more women kind of per quota numbers, though, in government would actually address some of the problems we have related to policy or lack thereof pertaining to paid parental leave or other family leave policies, et cetera. And that gets back to, I think there's a strong partisan or ideological component to this. So there are definitely women who support those sorts of things and men, but it doesn't seem to be equally distributed across the political spectrum. It's an ideological discussion. It's a political and a partisan discussion. And so just having more women, I'm not sure is going to be the solution, but I do think that having more women in another way provides this really nice environment and context for people to see the contributions that women make.
And that feels like a hopeful message. And in an obviously contentious election year, it's nice to have some hope. I'd like to end on a positive note. When you look at what's happened in the last few months, what gives you hope when you think about our election process and our democracy?
Well, I wish I could tell you a really rosy story right now. And I know we're trying to end on the uplifting note. And so I don't want to be a Debbie Downer here. You know, there's a lot of cause for concern that is well-founded. I will say that. What I will say is I still believe that the United States of America is an amazing country and one that can work and will work to fulfill all of the promises in our Constitution, in our Declaration of Independence, and our founding documents by fully expanding the rights of all people to be participatory and participate equally and equitably in our political process. It's a struggle. It can be an uphill battle, but I believe we're going to get there. And so my encouraging message to everyone is never to lose hope and just to vote. Make sure your voice is heard. Make sure you go to the polls or vote absentee ballot, et cetera. Get your friends and your family to do the same thing. Make a plan and vote. I really do think that we can make positive changes through that process.
My guest has been Anne Cismar, Associate Professor of Government at EKU. Thanks again, Anne.
Thank you so much, Jackie.
We touched on this earlier in the hour in the conversation with Fayette County Clerk Don Blevins. Being welcome at the polling place is not a given for some Kentuckians. From our series, State of Justice, the Criminal Justice System in Eastern Kentucky, here's Ray Geringer.
Kentucky is one of only two states in the nation that imposes a lifetime ban on voting for all people with felony convictions in their past, giving the state one of the highest disenfranchisement rates in the country. According to the Sentencing Project, in 2016, nearly 10% of Kentuckians and around 25% of Black Kentuckians couldn't vote because of a felony record. But despite years of organizing by formerly incarcerated people and their advocates, that lifetime ban on voting remains written into the Kentucky State Constitution. In December 2019, just days after he took office, Governor Andy Beshear signed an executive order that restored the right to vote to over 175,000 people with nonviolent, non-sexual felony convictions. But, organizers say, those people were not notified about the restoration of their rights. And so, leading up to the October 5th voter registration deadline, a coalition of organizations, including the ACLU of Kentucky, Kentuckians for the Commonwealth, and the League of Women Voters, have found creative ways to reach out to newly re-enfranchised voters in the time of COVID. Instead of door knocking, they've been text banking and calling over 65,000 people who were affected by Beshear's executive order. Marcus Jackson is the Smart Justice Organizing Coordinator for the ACLU of Kentucky, and he understands firsthand what it's like to lose the right to vote. He was convicted of a crime at the age of 19. He's now 48 years old, and he still doesn't have the right to vote.
What I do know is the impact that it actually has on a person when you return. Having been convicted of a felony, once you've completed your sentence, in the thought process of you're actually going to prison or taking on this sentence, and once that is done, your debt to society is paid. Looking at through that lens, there is absolutely no reason for you to lose your rights forever. So it tends to make people feel as if it doesn't matter. It's more of an extended punishment and all the negativity that comes with being a convicted felon in the first place. Lack of opportunity of housing, jobs, and education. Then you add the voting. And not having the ability to voice my approval or disapproval of our leaders is only a reminder of you see me as a second-class citizen.
Amanda Hall is a policy strategist for the ACLU of Kentucky who lives in Lawrence County. She's also a formerly incarcerated person who lost the right to vote when she was convicted of two felony offenses at the age of 26.
In 2010, I received two felony convictions. And I remember while being incarcerated and being shipped across the state and unable to have visits or see my family, I remember thinking that this is my punishment. And one day I will be out and I can move on with my life. Unfortunately, that's not how felony conviction goes, especially here in the state of Kentucky. You know, there are many obstacles and hurdles and collateral consequences that came along with my felony conviction. But probably one of the ones that hurt the worst was losing my right to vote. You know, I come from Martin County, Kentucky, and from a small child, I knew the importance of voting. You know, me and my mom, we didn't have much. I grew up in government housing, but my mom always tried really hard to provide a better life and with whatever means she had. And she would stress to us about how important it was to vote. I remember her voting every election. And so when I got out, I remember, you know, the first presidential election, I couldn't vote, how devastating that was. To me, I didn't feel like I was a full citizen in this beautiful state that's always been my home that I love so much.
Amanda's voting rights were reinstated in 2018 at the age of 34, but her rights were not restored through Governor Andy Beshear's executive order. Instead, she went through the long and complicated process of appealing to the governor for the restoration of her rights, a process which she said took years and spanned three different governors' terms. This is the only remaining option for over 130,000 people with felony convictions in Kentucky whose rights were not restored by the governor last December. Tanya Unruh Leemaster lives in Carter County, Kentucky, and she is one of the people whose right to vote was reinstated through Beshear's executive order. She can't quite remember when the last time she voted was, but she thinks it's been over 20 years. Tanya described going through a difficult and chaotic 10-year period, during which she struggled with substance use disorder and found herself in and out of jails and prisons. Then, she said, it took another 10 years on the outside to get to where she is now. Today, Tanya is committed to long-term recovery. She's 47 years old, and she works as the program supervisor for a maternal mom and infant treatment facility that offers addiction treatment to mothers who are pregnant or postpartum up to 6 months. In December of 2019, she got a message that shared the news of Beshear's executive order and included a link where she could find out whether or not her voting rights had been reinstated.
I remember when I did get that message, and my first thought was I shouldn't even click on that because I haven't voted in probably 20 years now. So why does that make a difference? You know, my first thought was that negative thinking, like my voice doesn't matter. But I followed through with it because what if it does work, and what if I can vote, and what if I can make a difference? You know, so it kind of instilled a little bit of hope and enthusiasm, like, wow. Not only am I out talking to these people face-to-face in the community, making amends to society and showing people that people change and being that face of recovery, but also now I can actually legitimately be a voting United States citizen. And it's kind of empowering, you know, like I never thought I'd have that again, but here I am.
Tanya hopes that moving forward, we can reduce the stigma facing those with felony convictions.
Hopefully we can decrease that stigma. Society knows that once you're a convicted felon, we don't want nothing to do with you. We don't want to give you a job. We don't want you voting. We don't even care about you because you've made a bad choice in your life. You know, if the world would get honest with themselves, I'm sure once in your life you always make a bad choice whether you have a felony or not. And that's where I kind of look at that, like, people make bad choices, but people recover and transform their lives as well. And they have great, wonderful lives, and they're wonderful parents, and they're wonderful workers, and they're a benefit to our community, to our nation, and to our world as a whole.
Amanda Hall celebrates the restoration of voting rights for the 175,000 covered by Bashir's executive order. But, she says, the fight isn't over until all Kentuckians with felony convictions have their rights restored and the Kentucky Constitution is changed.
After this election, in the General Assembly, going forward, Kentuckians have to raise their voice and say how important this issue is. We need to get this on the ballot. We have to change the Kentucky Constitution because what Governor Bashir has done with his executive order is not perhaps permanent. You know, that can be overturned by a new governor. Like, this is a huge issue, and we have to make sure that we get this through the General Assembly.
For anyone who has the right to vote but isn't planning to use it this November, Marcus Jackson has some thoughts.
Not only have there been countless people that have died for us to have the right to vote, people wouldn't be fighting so hard to prevent certain people from voting if it didn't matter. We must speak our truth on that ballot.
For Eastern Standard, I'm Ray Geringer.
State of Justice, a series exploring issues related to the criminal justice system in Eastern Kentucky, is provided to Eastern Standard by Ray Geringer and Amelia Kirby with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, a supporter of WEKU, and a grant from the Vera Institute of Justice. So the election's coming up, and it may be more accurate in this year that's seen historic levels of early voting to say that the election is really about to come to an end. Times are tough, no doubt. But as our guest, EKU political science professor Ann Sismar counsels,
my encouraging message to everyone is never to lose hope and just to vote. Make sure your voice is heard. Make sure you go to the polls or vote absentee ballot, etc. Get your friends and your family to do the same thing. Make a plan and vote.
Vote for me. Vote for me. I want the nomination for the presidency. Vote for me. Vote for me.
That wraps up this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard online at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. We do like to hear from you. Send us your ideas. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. Yeah.